North Texas Comic Book Show is a quarterly comic book convention, which has been in operation since late 2011. It started out in Arlington, Texas. It has since moved to Irving, which is directly northwest of Dallas. This was my first year attending the event. I came specifically to see Jim Starlin, which includes recording the panel he appeared on, referred to as the Two Jims, or the Two Jims, as in Jim the Name versus Jim the Jewel, a panel where Jim Shooter, former editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, as well as the big man behind Valiant, Defiant, and Broadway Comics, would interview Jim Starlin, the cosmic creator, probably best known for Thanos, as well as his reinvention of Adam Warlock. Really, though, it was more of a conversation, or at least a parallel panel where both men presided. This was recorded on February the 11th, 2018, I believe at around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I've never tried to record a panel before. I apologize if the audio quality isn't up to snuff. I also had some difficulties at the very beginning of the recording, so a portion of that footage is missing. I've also rearranged some of the footage I recorded. The problem was that audience members were asking questions toward the end of the panel, and for some reason they didn't have anybody around to pass them a microphone. These gentlemen were often speaking in a normal speaking voice while standing on bleachers in a noisy, crowded convention hall, so their questions were often inaudible. Thankfully, the Jims would typically recap the question that was asked of them, but not always. I'll try to fill in those gaps as best as I can recall, but in some instances it just made more sense to move the answers to the portions that had previously been covered in the one-on-one discussion, so that's what I've done.
Ladies and gentlemen, comic book fans, the moment you've been waiting for, Jim Shooter interviews Jim Starlin.
I am the aforementioned Jim Shooter, and this is Jim Starlin.
I'm the short Jim.
A lot of JSs running around in comics, Joe Simon, you know, Julie Schwartz, Joe Shuster. But, you know, this is one of the best. I've never interviewed anyone before in my life, so I'm just going to let him talk, and then I'll heckle him and say, that'll work, all right? So
it'll be different.
The thing I remember about your, you telling me about your early days was you were in the Navy, right? All right, was that before, did you start comics before that, then go to the Navy, or was it after?
It was after I started actually getting work. I was sending in drawings and complete comic strips, mostly of the Hulk, while I was in the Navy. I happened to work for what was an intelligence outfit, and we had our separate barracks that never had the lights on. But we had, because everyone worked 24 hours a day, but they allowed us to have these boxes, and along with our lockers, we had these huge boxes we could create. And most everybody saw.
I got TAD, the temporary assigned duty, there occasionally, and we were supposed to be the intelligence outfit for the entire Pacific facility.
Okay.
And so I would send these complete stories into Marvel, and they would send back nice little notes saying, well, you're almost there. And I remember once getting a real nice note from Herb Perkins. So I got out of the service and did a little stint in a community college for about 6 months. Still sending in drawings, but now I decided I was going to spread out, and so I sent some to DC. And among them was 2-page horror stories that Joe Orlando bought. And I figured, well, that's my entry. I've sold something, so I'm heading for New York now.
So you wrote and drew this, you sold it?
Basically, okay. Wrote and drew it, yeah.
Okay.
And they had different people ink it. A fellow named Wayne Howard inked one of them, and I can't remember who inked the other one. It might have been Dave Cochran.
Wow.
Yeah, I might be hazy on that one. But I showed up in New York, and I brought one suitcase with clothes in it and one suitcase with all my comic records. I came in on the Port Authority bus terminal and set the suitcase down on the sidewalk out front, the one with the comic books. And this really nice gentleman comes running up and says, oh, let me help you with that. And he got about six paces before he realized that he was going to herniate himself with this. And he put it down, gave me a dirty look, and walked off with his friend who was supposed to distract me while he stole the suitcase. So,
welcome to New York.
Yes, that was my very first thought. And I said, I'm going to like it here.
Dave Cochran, by the way, was also in the Navy.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
And what he was doing, what you were doing, except he had sketchbooks, and he showed them to me. While he was in the Navy, he designed all the new X-Men. I mean, exactly as they appeared, and also wrote notes about their characters and stuff. He's the real primary creator of the New X-Men. But anyway, I digress.
Okay, did something similar, but my creation of Thanos took place between the time I got out and before I came to New York City.
Yeah.
But I eventually came and got some work up at Marvel. They were going from, I think, 8 books a month to, I think, like 20. And so they were quite literally hiring anybody who could come across the state line and hold a pencil.
Yeah.
I just barely qualified at this at that point.
By the way, the reason for that was because during the 60s, Martin Goodman had lost his distributor in the late 50s. It's a long story, but he had a distributor, he went to a new distributor, they folded, and then he had no distributor. So he went literally with his hat in his hand to DC Comics because they own Independent News, which is a distributor. They didn't want any more comics, they had DC Comics. But kind of, you know, as a favor to him, they agreed that he could have 8 comics. And then eventually I think it was raised to 12. But all through the 60s, Marvel was constrained. They couldn't publish a lot of books. When Marvel was bought by a company called Perfect Chemical, which later changed its name to Cadence Industries, Cadence Industries happened to own Curtis Circulation. And so Marvel switched to Curtis Circulation, and all of a sudden, all the restraints were off. And so they started publishing way too many books way too quickly. Go on.
Well, they hired me. And my first job was to work with Stan doing cover layouts for other artists to pencil up, like Gil Kane and John Buscema, who were doing a lot of work at that time. And every day I would come in and I would pull out the Xeroxes and look to see what was inside each book, and then I would design up a cover. And Stan would come in around noon, and it was always the same thing. He would look them over and he'd go, "Hey, these are great, these are perfect, but..." And then he would take off his glasses, he would set them on the chair, and he would get up on the table, on his desk, and he would act out how he wanted the Silver Surfer to be the, you know, to look on the cover.
I can vouch for that. He did this for me, too.
Yeah. You know, he was a frustrated actor. I mean, he wanted to be an actor when he was a kid, and then his uncle said, "You got to do this," and said.
You know, it was usually the coffee table with me.
Okay, no, he got up on the desk.
All right.
And he always set his glasses onto the damn chair behind him.
So you were the de facto art director.
That's what I eventually became. As I realized my drawing was getting a little bit better, I'd make corrections on other people. And basically, they eventually got Frank Giacoya, and they gave him the post for about a month or two. But he couldn't keep up with it, and then eventually John Romita became the first real official one.
Were you on staff?
No, I was doing piecework.
All freelance, okay.
But the where I was heading with the story was that Stan would forget about his glasses about one out of every 10 times, and then he would sit down on them and crush them. And he never missed a beat. He'd look at the glasses, he'd go over and push the intercom button and go, "I did it again." And his secretary would come in with a fresh pair of glasses, give it to him, she would run off with a broken pair, and we'd go on from there.
Yes, Stan was like that. He probably still is.
Yeah, so it was kind of fun. They eventually trusted me enough to do one of these covers myself. The first two covers I do was the Beast. When he was that blue furry thing. I guess he's a blue furry thing still now. He knows. And I did a few little small jobs here and there, like a love story and a couple of horror stories. And then George Tuska, who was the regular artist on Iron Man, had to go in for some kind of operation. So Roy Thomas, who was the editor at the time, said, "Can you do a couple of fillings?" And the first one I did was with Mike Friedrichs, and that was Iron Man 55, which introduced Thanos and Drax. We had a lot of fun with that one. The second issue, they said, "You're going to be working with this new guy we got, Steve Gerber." And we decided we were going to do a funny episode of Iron Man. So
you know Howard the Duck, Steve Gerber, right?
Yes. So we did a funny episode of with Rasputin the Mad Magician and some big stone thing, and it came out, and Stan saw it, and he hated it, and he fired both River and I right on the spot. Roy felt bad about this, and he said, well, we got this other book, and it's probably not going to last long, but we're going to need a couple of fill-in issues. So if you could come in and do an issue or two of this thing called Captain Marvel, we'd really appreciate it. So getting fired about Iron Man is probably one of the better things that happened to me. I would have been eventually, I would have had to draw a car or a horse or something on Iron Man. That's something I'm not really good at.
So how did I have to get to Warlock?
How did I get to Warlock? I did a run with Captain Marvel, and every issue had a different inker.
Okay, it was Steve Englehart writing it, right?
Captain Marvel is starting off with Mike Friedrichs.
Oh, okay.
And then we had one issue that I broke up into three different parts, and I said, you know, Mike had five books that he was writing at that point, and I said, you know, I'd like to write this book myself. And Roy said, okay, well, why don't you write the middle chapter, and we'll let Mike frame you, and if I like it, you can do it, because Mike has five books, and we'll give him another one. It worked out, I started writing it, and poor Mike, like about 2 months later, they canceled all his books. I mean, every single one of them. I mean, he had things like Kazar and things that weren't selling all that well to begin with.
Back in the early 70s, it was kind of a downtime for the whole industry, but Marvel in particular ran into some icebergs.
So we continued on with Captain Marvel, and I was always promised a permanent inker. Finally, Klaus Janson got on the book. And I was promised over and over, Klaus is it permanently. The next issue, we ended up with Jack Abel, who was a good anchor, but he came out of nowhere, and we had a big argument about it, and I ended up going over to DC for a while. Did a few jobs there, and then I came back and was talking to Roy, and he said, what book would you like to do? So I said, I'll look about it, and I'll think about it. I'll come back and we'll talk about it tomorrow. And so that night, I went back to my apartment, and I had this book, box full of comic books that I had brought from Detroit that I almost herniated the teeth with. And went through them and finally came across Warlock. I just thought it was a great-looking costume and that. I hadn't thought about having to draw that lightning bolt on his chest all the time.
All right, now Warlock at that point, when you came across it, it was in somebody else's book, right? He was a character in FF or something?
No, he was, had his own book. Gil Kane started off drawing it. Bob Brown ended up taking over it. Okay. It was they were doing a Jesus Christ Superstar thing with it.
He was introduced in the Fantastic Four, correct?
As him.
All right.
Yeah, and then he showed up in the Thor book where Thor beat him up really bad. And then Roy and Gil started him up as Adam Warlock.
Okay.
Gil was suggesting the name Adam.
Right.
Yeah. And so I said, it's okay if we try and do this one? And he said, sure, go ahead. And that same night I went home and drew the first page of the first issue. And Roy was kind of good to work with because he was so overrun with work. Because they had no assistant editors like you did.
They didn't have any organization at all, you know. I mean, basically, when Stan was there, he did all the creative, and he had a guy named Saul Brodsky who did anything that was legal, financial, technical, or complicated. And that was the organization. That was it. There was a few other people in the office. And then basically, if they used somebody outside, they just kind of left them alone, you know, because there was nobody to check anything, you know. Which was, you know, both good and bad. Archie Goodwin always used to say, you get a few guys like this, and they'll do great stuff. You give them that freedom, they'll do great stuff. And then they get a lot of crap. And then, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And Archie just said, yes, we can. But anyway, go on.
Well, at this time, the entire Marvel organization fit into a room about a quarter of the size of this chamber here.
Yeah, see, because Roy just... He didn't build an organization. He just tried to run like Stan, except that now there was like 40 books.
Yeah, so it was utter chaos. And I would come in and to talk to Roy about the plot that month, and I'd say, I think I'd like to use the Super Scroll. And go with it. And that was my entire plot synopsis. So when I could go get home and start working on it, if I got a bright idea in the middle of the story, I could change everything right there on the spot. No one would ever know the difference. And I'd just be able to play around wherever I wanted to go. It's a lot different these days. Now the editors want a very concise plot, and if you divert from it, which I tend to do, you tend to get them convinced with short fits. So it's a little trickier these days. But, we did Warlock. I ended up going out to California for a bit, and, from there, things just went on from that point.
Okay, you wrote and drew Warlock. Did you ink it?
I inked, the first two or three issues, I forget which, and I was out there in California, and there was this young guy named Steve Leoloa.
Yeah, one of the great artists, great inkers that we ever had.
So I asked him to start inking it, and we got it approved from our worker to do that. It's kind of after the fact, as I recall.
Yeah, but see, that's just it. Everybody was kind of their own little, shop, and he was at least courteous enough to mention it to the office. And like you say, Roy said, yeah, well, go ahead, because he's busy.
Well, at this point, Roy was gone, and I think we were going through a turnstile of editors. There was Jerry Conway for 2 weeks.
No, what happened was Roy was there for 2.5 years.
Right, but after that.
And then he left, and Jerry Conway had been promised the job, by Stan. However, Marv Wolfman and Len Wein and a lot of other people, they didn't like Jerry. And so they went to Stan, the Citizens Vigilance Committee, and they convinced him not to hire Jerry. They said, "Oh, real quick, And so Stan said, "Well, who should I hire?" And Marv said, "Len." And so Len served for 8 months. And then he had trouble. He was not well. He had trouble showing up on time. He was addicted to soap operas, so he came in at 1 in the afternoon. I'm serious. And so anyway, after that, that was plainly not working out. And so Stan said to Len, "Well, you have to give this up. But who else should I get? Marv." And so Marv was there for exactly a year, and he kind of got forced out. And so then Stan said, "Aha, Jerry." And so Jerry was working at DC, and so he called Jerry. Roy was going to come back. And then he changed his mind. But Stan says, "Jerry." So Jerry comes in, and the fear and loathing was palpable. But he was really trying to do the right thing. He was trying to get things on time. But it was a
second time.
Yeah. And so Jim's right, it lasted 2 or 3 weeks, and the pressure was too much, and he finally said, "I can't keep this." So he went off to be a writer-editor, and that's when Archie came in. Yes, Archie came in as editor. He was there for 19 months, and then they had run out of warm bodies. By the time that Archie was ready to leave, they'd run out of warm bodies, and so they gave it to me.
Yeah, we both seem to have started off our careers at Marvel by the fact that there was a big gap and hole somewhere.
Let me talk about a little bit about Warlock. See, when I first started at Marvel, I came in to be interviewed, basically the job Marv was describing, Marv was the editor. He was describing me was editor. And I said, "Oh, so you want me to be the editor?" And he didn't like the word editor, because he said, "Well, I'm the editor." I said, "No, you're the editor-in-chief." And he said, "Well, I don't want to call you editor." I said, "All right, what?" So he would come up on associate, whatever. "I'm the editor of the books." All right, so, and I'm checking the plots and checking the art against the plot and checking the scripts and doing what an editor does, I was kind of I was second in command, so I was kind of in charge of all what they called the proofreaders, the other people in that little editorial area. Before I got to that point, so I was interviewed, I accepted the job, I had to come back a couple days later to start work. And when I walked in, the first thing they did is they handed me a Captain Marvel and said, "Can you help us? Can you proofread this? the new editor's here, And so...
Probably my scripting was really horrible at the time.
I thought it was good. But anyway, so I'm trying to do this thing where I'm reading the plot. And this was new, because nobody had ever bothered with this before. Like I said, it was kind of anarchy. So now here comes the blue meanie. I was going to, read the plot and make sure it's okay. But a lot of things crossed my desk. A lot of them were very good. And one of the things that crossed my desk that really blew my mind was Warlock. I mean, it was intense. It was font full, and you had these 16-panel pages.
It got a little strange at times. Yeah.
Very strange. But it was so good. The only complaint I ever had with it was the coloring was so dark and murky.
Yeah, I could see that. It was my coloring at the time, and I wanted to go that way.
It was your fault.
Yeah.
Okay.
Entirely.
So, anyway, no, but I thought that this blew my mind. It was so innovative and so, I've never seen anything like that before. And I thought it was great.
Well, I always like to take a character on a journey when I tell a story. I mean, they always should go from point A to point D or whatever it is. And what the fun part is the points in between. Like with Captain Marvel, and it took him from being a warrior to sort of a Jesus Christ kind of methodical, messianic, thank you, figure. And then we got onto Warlock, and he was at the same spot that I had left Captain Marvel at, so I said, I got to go someplace different. So the most logical place to take a godlike figure is to turn him into a schizophrenic, suicidal paranoid. And that's what we did with him, and that was a lot of fun. So, you were going, seeing my journeys and working out all my Catholic upbringing.
I love the fact that you use the word journey, because when I'm doing my writing lecture, I explain the foundations of the language and how, the units of the language have definitions, but don't limit you. A sentence has a definition. It's a complete thought. It is never limited to the writers of Laverne and Shirley or Hemingway or Shakespeare. It's just a definition of what this thing is. A story is a complete journey. Okay? That's a fact. I love that you use that word.
Okay. Let's make it kind of hard for the people who have to follow me, though.
No, I think I'm having trouble following you. It's like if there was a prejudice against what they considered science fiction at Marvel. I don't know if you knew that. I mean, I've had people say all the time, oh, this stuff doesn't sell. I even had one guy who, I won't mention his name, but one guy, he would say things, he would say, good doesn't sell. He says, what the kids in Fudge, Nebraska want is for Hulk to pound the ground and the little shockwaves to go and all the soldiers to fall down. He said, that's what they want, you know. I said, you are so wrong. You know, that's just so wrong. We gotta expand the impact. We gotta do great things. And he was. And unfortunately, it wasn't getting any support. And I guess they canceled it, right? Or when you left?
I left before, and then they canceled it because they ran out of people. There was a number of good books. Phil Raven got canceled. They couldn't get paper from Canada for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
So there was like six
paper crisis. Yeah, you're right.
I was kind of pleased to see that, because that ended the Warlock without it going on and going in different directions.
Yeah, but at least he found out who the Magus was.
Yeah, we stuck around long enough to do that.
Yeah, he basically finished the journey. But that was just wonderful stuff. And when you did you see for a moment?
I went over to D.C. for a little bit after that. I was doing a lot of freelance, Warren magazine. We did some posters, was selling some stuff, Starreach.
You left when Jerry Conway was editor, right, for those 3 weeks?
Yes, it was somewhere around there. Yeah. I don't quite remember what the cause was on that one.
Well, the way I remember it is that Jerry had an argument, a big argument, with Steve Englehart, who did tend to be late sometimes, and that Steve left in a huff, and that you kind of left in solidarity. That's what I remember.
Yeah, I don't remember that part.
But you left at the same time.
Yeah, we left at the same time, but I think it was for different reasons.
Okay.
And I can't exactly recall at this point.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so how long were you away from Marvel?
Until Archie became the editor, and I came back from California, and he said, would you like to do one of our annuals?
Now, this is great. I was there as an editor, and you did 3 annuals that were all one story. Two?
Two.
Two and one, and Iron Man?
No, two and one and the Avengers.
Two and one and the Avengers.
It was Avengers, and then it went to 2 and 1.
Okay, so now, the thing is, all right, so this thing comes across my desk. And this is the precursor to Secret Wars, okay? Because there were so many characters in it, such a big story. Thanos, the villain. Thanos, the villain. The Spider-Man's in there, the Thing is in there, all these, the Avengers are in there, a lot of people in there, a lot of characters. And it was, I would say the major difference was that it was almost impossible at that point to coordinate with the ongoing continuity in the regular books. So it didn't violate the continuity, but it was kind of off to the side, you know. But I think that was the first test case for Secret Wars.
Yeah, it was just sort of, we did the Avengers, and I got done with it a lot quicker than Archie and anybody expected me to. And they said, would you like to do another one? And I just moved back to New York, and rents are expensive there, so I jumped at the chance of another one, and we did the 2-in-1 annual, and I was being lazy, so I said, well, I'm just going to continue on this story, because if it's 2-in-1 annual, I can throw in extra characters in that. And as I recall, we weren't quite sure. I knew Spider-Man, I wanted to do something with him because he had never really done aliens before. And my whole journey with him was having to deal and learn how to deal with aliens that were something that he'd never had a face before.
I have to say, I'm sitting there reading these boards as they come across my desk, you know, and first of all, perfectly clean copy. I mean, it didn't need any corrections. I'm just reading it, you know? And I have to say, I mean, by that point, I had done my homework, and I was reasonably expert on all the characters. I mean, the ones I already knew, but then the new ones, I figured out who they were, and I felt comfortable with the characters of all the characters. And he nailed it, every one. Everybody talked in character, everybody did things that they would do, and nobody did anything that they wouldn't do. And you just absolutely nailed it. And I'll tell you something, if you get a chance to find those two annuals, that is one hell of a read. It really is.
Who drew them? Who drew them? I drew them. Joe Rubenstein inked both of them. I believe he inked, I got tired of inking the Avengers, and so he took over on that one, and then he did the inks on the follow-up book and that.
So it's a good-looking book, too. I mean, it's beautiful. It's great stuff. Yeah. Anyway, get a chance. If you can find those books, I'm telling you, it's worth a read.
It's that story that got Thanos into the movies, because Josh Whedon tells me that he saw that, and he just sort of fell in love with the books, and when they made him the creative director at the Marvel Cinema for about 15 minutes, he was the one who was responsible for slipping Thanos into the end credits of the first Avengers movies, and that's what led to them building up this entire cinematic 10-people journey that you're going to be coming to an end of that this summer, or next summer, actually.
Yeah, those are great books. I really like them. And, all right, so what else did you do between there and Redstone?
I think we went on to Dread Star. Archie quit as the editor-in-chief. You took over on that. I started working for Archie on Dread Star right at that point.
Okay, so there's
more personalities.
Well, it doesn't happen quite that fast. Archie left at the end of 1977, and I started on the first working day of January 1978. And I was the only editor we had. I'm supposed to edit 45 color comics a month, you know. So then I'm not there at all. So there's no one. And so even though I was trying to be editor-in-chief, I still had to edit those comics until we got some help. And I finally managed to get the authority to hire three editors, one of whom did not work out. And the president of the company actually ordered me to fire him after he made a $60,000 mistake. He didn't get something approved. It was a light license. Planet of the Apes. He didn't get it approved. And we had to scrap the entire printer because they did not approve. He sent it to the printer anyway, and they didn't approve it. So anyway, I got rid of him. And then we were talking about starting this magazine, which originally was called Odyssey, and we couldn't use that name. So then we wanted to use Epic. We couldn't use that name. So they called it Epic Illustrator. And so this guy I fired, he had kind of started on it, not much. Sam says, well, you know, who can we get? And I said, the best man in the world for this job is Archie Goodwin. I said, but I used to be his assistant, and he might feel funny coming in and being, you know, working for me. And so we worked out this scheme where Stan would hire me. I'd just stay away. Stan would hire me, and then pretend that he reported to Stan. And meanwhile, because Archie was not great at the administrative stuff, the greatest, maybe the greatest creator this business has ever known, brilliant, brilliant man, genius. But he wasn't really good at it. When he talked to lawyers or accountants, his eyes would glaze over. I mean, so I said to Stan, I said, what we'll do is I'll pave the road. I'll do all that. And you can make out like, you know, I'm working for him. And it's fine. And so that's how we did it. And so we got Archie to come in. It was one of the best things that ever happened to us. And then, so he's doing this magazine, Epic Illustrated, and this creator room. Okay? So then a little while after that, and I don't know if you remember this, but you, Simonson, and Miller came to see me. And you said, hey, why can't we do Creator Own series? Like just regular comics, except Creator Own. And I said, well, we can. And they said, you mean you can just decide that? And I said, yeah. I had previously had Sergio come and ask me the same question. And the answer was yes, but he decided to go with Pacific Comics. But at any rate, so yeah, I didn't know I could do it. So anyway, they didn't believe me. So I took them in to see the publisher. And I told them, these guys want to do Creator Own comic series. He says, yeah, so what are you bothering me for? You know? And I said, well, I'm going to need some help with the contracts. Okay. So off they go. And the way it worked out is Walt decided instead to do a graphic novel, Star Signs. Frank got romanced by Jeanette Kahn and ended up going over to D.C.
Roman, yes.
He did do Roman. And he was the only guy that stuck around. And you did Dreadstar. I remember I walked into Archie Goodwin's office and I said, Archie, Epic Comics. And he said, he lost his mind at it. He said, I'm too busy, I can't do all the work. And so he chased me out of his office, you know, and I'm like, you know, because he's 140 pounds of twisted steel, man. You don't mess with him. And so he was.
Archie's fame was that he could fall down any staircase very realistically without hurting himself. I watched him go down the entire flight of stairs at the Illustrators Club in New York and then pop up and say, ha-ha.
He's the master of the pratfall. He was absolute master. But at any rate, so he chases me out of his office. And so I didn't know what to do. So I went to Al Milgram, who was one of my editors. And I said, Al, you want to do this? And he said, sure. So you'll notice on the first issue of Dreadstar, it has a dual credit, Milgram and Goodwin. And the reason is because the next day, Archie Goodwin came to my office and said, how dare you give Epic Comics to Milgram? You know, that's Epic is mine, you know? I'm like, make up your mind. And so anyway, then I went to Al and I said, got to give it back to Archie. And he said, oh, I want to, you know, because he wanted to do it because Jim was his friend and everything. And so anyway, like I said, I got them to split the credit of the first issue and then I beat Milgram up enough so that he let it go. And Archie became the editor, the only editor of Dreadstar and all subsequent Epic items. And so how'd that go?
Oh, well, Archie was the editor I worked for longer than any other editor, so I'd have to say it worked fairly well. We did like about 40 issues in that together, and I've never lasted more than 8 or 10 with anybody else.
Archie was... See, I'm too loud and obnoxious, you know? Archie, in his kinder, gentler way, would get across the same kind of things that I was preaching, because, you know, we all felt the same way. You know, you didn't have to tell Archie, you didn't have to tell Louise anything, you didn't have to tell Larry anything. I mean, you know, we all had that mindset, let's tell a story. But he was, everybody loved Archie. You know, he was so easy to work with, you know? And I think because he was like the kinder, gentler, you know, editor. And I paved the road for him. And, you know, so he could work on the creative. And Dreadstar was our biggest hit.
Yeah, so that worked out well for quite a long time. We ended up going away from Marvel with Dreadstar because of things that happened in bookkeeping, which were editorial. But eventually came back to Marvel after I did a stint over at DC where I killed Robin. And after we killed Robin, they discovered that they had all these lunch boxes and pajamas with Robin on top of it. So within about 2 or 3 months, my work at DC disappeared. It just all dried up. So I ended up back over at Marvel, and that's when we did the Infinity Gauntlet and Silver Surfer, so it worked out fine in the long run. It was just kind of discombobulating at the time.
What year was it?
How would I know?
I think this was after I left.
Yes.
Now, see, when I was toward the end of my time, the board of directors of Cadence took the company private, so the whole corporation was owned by 6 guys, including, you know, Marvel was part of the corporation, and they decided to sell it. And things started getting really ugly. He says something went wrong in bookkeeping. It was because they were deliberately not paying people. And so I got in fights with them all the time, and they finally got rid of me. And then, you know, people like you realize you were being screwed. And, you know,
went elsewhere.
And went elsewhere, as you would. So anyway, I mean, that's just so you get that little piece of history. So I wasn't there.
Okay.
So, all right, so next. Jetstar has had life beyond Marvel, right?
Yes, yeah, so let's see, it went over to First, then there was a Malibu female version of Red Star that Ernie Colan and Peter David did.
But you owned it.
I owned it, yes.
Yes, creator owned.
Yes, they were working on it over at Malibu because I was working on another character called Reed, which I was writing and drawing. And then Malibu folded up, and since then we've been reprinting the Red Star stuff through Dynamic, or Dynamite, which they call themselves now. It was Dynamic Forces, and now it's Dynamite Comics. And I was going to do a new version, and actually started on it. I've got a first issue all drawn up of a new and final Red Star story, and then I went and blew a big hole in my hand, and that kind of ended my drawing career. And so somewhere down the line, we're going to finish off the Red Star story by finding a good artist who wants to work with me on this, and we'll eventually get it out. But right now, some of these pages are going to show up in this Art of Jim Starlin book that ought to be coming out through Ominous Press around April, around the time the movie comes out. I've got a bunch of stuff coming out.
All right, this last question, not to bring up a bad subject, but do you want to talk about the animation and movie thing that happened?
The animation and movie thing.
The movie that didn't happen because the producer died.
We were going to have a Red Star TV series in the work.
TV series, I see.
Yes. We signed up with Universal. We had a couple of scripts done, and then our main producer had a little substance abuse problem, went into rehab for a couple of months, disappeared for a while, and then when he came back out, he OD'd and died. So the Red Star thing is sort of in limbo right now. I have this suspicion that producers are a superstitious lot, and if you have one die on you, they're kind of hesitant to work with you again.
All right, another last question. So you've been doing like consulting work on the movies and stuff?
No. There's no consulting between Marvel and Marvel Comics and movie people. They've got a nice separate wall there.
Okay.
I've been invited down to the set to the still unnamed Avengers movie, the fourth one. Got a nice tour, was treated very nicely. The folks at Disney and Marvel Entertainment treat me quite well.
Yeah. All right, so maybe we should take some questions, all right? Can you talk a little bit about the development of the Marvel cosmic hierarchy, is what you said?
Okay, it sort of happened by accident. The stories in the, I think it was the Infinity Gauntlet when I got them all together there, you're talking about, they've given them a name now. They're not the Elders. The Elders were the champions or something. Maybe they are the Elders, but they're Eternity, Infinity, and that sort of characters. I needed a pantheon of gods, and I just sort of went through the books and said,
oh, you know, we got to do Infinity, or we got to do Eternity, definitely.
I didn't know about Infinity at first. Somebody instructed me on that, I remember. And I just went through and picked out the coolest looking characters and said, these are the toughest guys in the universe, and we're going to put them together, and They're the ones who are going to say that we're very upset about Warlock running around with the Infinity Gauntlet and something ought to be done about it. So there wasn't a lot of thought put into it. They were cool-looking characters, and I needed some fillers.
There was a lot of thought put into it. Another question? Anybody? All right, there.
Okay, we're going to Warlock.
I was going to have Adam Warlock kick Drax the Destroyer's ass. You know, that was set up to be the next issue. I know I probably had more than that involved, but basically that's what I was setting it up for, because I knew that I wanted to get all these guys together. I was trying to gather all my little toy soldiers that I created into one book. I've always tried to make more of my own little universe than just, you know, I never spread out into the Marvel universe trying to do people coming into Spider-Man. I would bring them into our universe, my universe, and try and do things. It was mostly a case of trying to avoid having to deal with all the hassles of continuity. When we were doing the Infinity Gauntlet, we had a hard time getting all the characters that I wanted. By that time, a lot of the editors had set up little fiefdoms of their own, and that's why we only were allowed to do two X-Men inside the Infinity Gauntlet. Bob Harris didn't want us to touch his characters, and someone finally, I guess it was Tom or somebody who was an editor in chief at that point, finally said, you got to let him have two.
Must be Tom.
Yeah. I was working with Craig Anderson at the time, so I'm a little hazy on what the rest of the hierarchy was. I was living up north, and I mostly communicating through phone at that point. But after the Infinity Gauntlet worked out so well in the tie-ins, we had the exact same thing. The opposite problem entirely. We got to Infinity War, and everybody wanted their character stuck into this thing because it would help the sales of the books that had been peripheral edges of it on the previous book. And so I was stuck having to work with some of these characters I had no idea. There was one guy named Sleepwalker, I believe. Yeah, I mean, some hooded guy. And I had to fit him in there somewhere, and I'd never read one of his books, but they sent me a little synopsis and a picture of what he looked like. There was a couple other ones in that, but you know, we had to juggle these things out, so War was a little bit more confusing, doubly confusing, because we were doing villainous versions of all the same characters, which is where I think Carnage came out of, and so it was... I created a mess that was really great. It caused a lot of bedlam for about 6 months while we were doing this project.
Yeah, but you had a lot of help creating that mess, and they weren't cooperating very well.
They weren't too bad at that point. You know, we had to get the new villainous guys approved each time, and that was kind of a slow process.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we'd send in the nasty Spider-Man that Ron Lindley grew up, and then maybe one little change here and there. And it would sometimes take us a couple of weeks before we heard back from everybody. Yeah. Nothing was very quick.
It's an organization, and part of keeping an organization running is the compromise. And yeah, maybe I didn't want Sleepwalker in the Infinity Wars, but it was a good thing to do so that I would not have trouble getting the book out. This was after your time. There was one editor in particular who really hated the fact that I was getting all these books to write that he thought somebody else should be getting. I did the Infinity War and the Infinity Gauntlet, and I was scheduled to do another one called the Infinity Crusade. And this editor really put up a stink about it. And Tom DeFalco, who was the editor-in-chief, decided to solve the problem by taking my crusade off the official schedule. And so around the office, everybody thought the crusade had been canceled. And in the meantime, Craig Anderson and I were still working on it and getting it all set up to go. And I recall running into this editor at by the elevator banks as I was leaving one day, and he went, "Hey, it's too bad about that crusade." And I went, "Yeah, maybe next time." And then the next week, they put out the new schedule, and he found out it was still on the schedule all the time. That was a really strange book to work on because it had religious overtones. And religious overtones, it was all about religion. And so I was trying to figure out what every character's religion was. And so they actually got Jim Salicrup to go through and help me out and try and figure out. And we found out, like Sue Storm would have been Catholic, and, Dr. Strange might have picked up some kind of Buddhism or something along the way. I mean, we had it all worked out, and we got down to the end, and we realized that this company that had been founded and created by all Jewish talent didn't have one Jewish character in the lot. And in the end, it turned out to be Sasquatch because he was from Poland.
The answer to the beginning of the question is, how did it happen? Well, obviously, in the 60s, when Stan was writing everything, there was no problem coordinating among himself. When the company changed, was bought by Perfect Chemical, which became Cadence Industries, at that time, after some wrangling, Stan ended up being the president of the company. He was a lousy president. He's not a businessman, so he stepped down from there and he became, quote, publisher. He wasn't the publisher either. His job was to be Stan, and he spent a lot of time on the road doing lectures and stuff like that. And when he was back in the office, he was on the 10th floor. We were on the 6th, he was on the 10th. And he was working with the magazines, because we used to publish these crummy magazines. It wasn't us, it was Magazine Management Incorporated. So he worked with them. When those were dying, he fled, and he came back downstairs. Right about the time I started, he came back. All right, now, in the meantime, okay, after
he had no idea who Howard the Duck was.
And in the meantime, while he was on this little journey, Roy Thomas became the editor-in-chief. He was the first editor-in-chief. Stan just followed himself editor. So Roy Thomas was the first editor-in-chief. And the thing is, like, as I said, there was no organization built. The number of titles expanded exponentially. And so what happened is practically everybody was their own editor. Every writer was a writer-editor. And so that's how the fiefdom started. Because if you were writing the Fantastic Four, then you felt like you owned any characters associated with the Fantastic Four. If you were writing Spider-Man, you owned Dr. Octopus. It started breaking down that way. And if somebody wanted to use Dr. Octopus someplace else, they'd get a screamstorm from whoever was writing Spider-Man. So anyway, it sort of started to divide up into little fiefdoms, and then it got worse when there started to be a lot of writer-editors, because every time an editor-in-chief would leave, he'd become a writer-editor. And so now you got, like, Roy, who, had his little nuclear umbrella that, protected his stuff, and, Len and Marv, and so when I came in there, I mean, I said, that's going to stop. And it did, for about 10 years. And then apparently it went right back. Well, anyway. Anyone other questions? Come on.
He asked where I was going to take Red Star, and will take Red Star. There has been a big lapse of time since the last Red Star issue and now. And so I was going to have a lapse of time in there also, where he's been out doing things and is returning to where Willow, who became disembodied and is running the computer which runs everything, and he's going to be reunited with most of the characters that were from the past during that time. I don't want to say anything more because it is going to be an end story, and I can't promise you any happy ending, sorry.
Another question? Anybody? Over here? He's asking him the difference between working at Marvel and DC and the differences between the companies. Different philosophy.
It comes down to more of the fact that you have different people you're working with. it's more like who the editor is, because whoever they brought in, it becomes a culture that is different than, say, what it was 10 years ago. I could work at DC and then come back later on and find that everybody there was changed, all the editors were moved. And when you get a group of folks together, they get a mindset, in which case you come in and you work with that particular mindset. The one advantage that DC had over Marvel was DC had the better production department.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they had this guy named Jack Adler who knew how to do everything.
He taught me production.
But the editors, working with the editors, it wasn't so much what was going on in that particular headspace as a group. It was more like the individuals. I came back at one point and did a thing with Bernie Wrightson called The Weird at DC, and it was another case where we wanted to get some other characters because it was going to be a shoot off, they were going to be tied in with the Justice League. And the story was that at the end, Superman and another character, which was originally going to be Captain Marvel, were taken over by these Macrolats or whatever they were called, and the Justice League and Weird had to fight Superman and Captain Marvel. We couldn't use Captain Marvel at the time because there was some kind of still craziness with the contracts. And then we went to Wonder Woman, and the editor of Wonder Woman wouldn't let us use Wonder Woman. And we went through this whole line of characters. We were trying to find somebody powerful to use to team up with Superman and get taken over. And we ended up with somebody named Nuclear, who I had, once again, had absolutely no idea who he was, had to get a really brief history on him, and then worked him into the story. And Bernie, who was drawing the story, really hated the guy's costume, so it made it even more difficult.
You know, the thing is, the fiefdom thing, when I first started at Marvel, there were a lot of old fiefdoms, you know, writer-editors, and they didn't want you to, you know, use any character they were using and stuff like that. And I put a stop to that. I said, no, these are not your characters. These are Marvel Comics characters. And if somebody else wants to use that character, the answer is yes. And it might be yes, but, can you wait a month? But it's yes. And so for at least the 10 years I was there, we were much freer about the cross-pollinization thing. And also, the other thing, I thought maybe the other, maybe only the smart thing I did was that when somebody knew what they were doing, you leave them alone, you know? Nobody had to tell Walt Simonson anything on Thor. You don't have to direct him. First of all, he's a big gun, you can't aim. You know, you hire Walt, you get Walt. You say, draw it a little more like Buscema. No, he will draw it like Walt. You know, you say, this is the kind of story I want you to tell. He says, that's not the kind of story I want to tell. You know, so he's a big gun, you can't aim. But fortunately, he's pointed in the right direction. So that's fine. But anyway, what we found that, you know, like, if you got good guys, leave them alone. Give them some space. They want to use somebody, work it out.
I was always kind of surprised that they were worried about it, because I never broke any of the guest stars I had. It was only my main characters I was breaking.
Yeah, and so anyway, the thing is, that was our philosophy, and that's one of the big differences between Marvel and DC, because when I worked at DC, they had rules and rules and rules. And, you know, like Julie Schwartz had the list of rules about Superman that you had to do. Every issue you had to have Superman's identity, secret identity threatened to be revealed, and they had to do some kind of clever escape. And, I mean, all these rules, you know? But we didn't have that. And like I said, we had good guys that left them alone. Now, the new kids, the young guys, and even some of the old guys, they needed a little help. You know, but fortunately we had people like Archie and Asenny and, you know, people who could help them. And, you know, it came out pretty good. I think that after I left, I think it sort of degenerated into fiefdom some more than it
was. And they got rules. I did this one short story arc involving the Punisher. And when I came in to talk to the editor about it, in all sincerity, he said, we have two rules with the Punisher. If he shows up in the story with somebody, within a few pages, he has to kill that person. And he said, rule number two is...
That's stupid.
And he said, rule number two was, if he shows up in an object in the story with the Punisher, that object has to get blown up or set on fire within a few pages.
That is so bloody stupid.
Strangely enough, I ignored it.
Any other questions? I got a question. All right, how about you? You want to talk into the mic?
I understood his question. It was, how does technology change the creative process? In my particular case, computers really cleaned up my act. I used to paint or do the coloring, and I would come down to dinner and I would have a half hour of cleaning up afterwards because I worked a lot with oils. The first time I started, as soon as I started working with the coloring on the computer, I would come down a half hour earlier and I'd go, there's nothing to wash off. It made lettering easier. I tried to warn all the letterers that they should start learning how to use these things. Maybe half of them did. The rest of them ended up unemployed. So there was a mixed bag on technology. The coloring is so much better looking than the comic.
Well, it looks better on the screen than usually on the comic.
Yeah, there's no longer those little dots unless you want them there.
Well, that's the printing, though. I mean, now they're doing the offset printing on everything.
Yeah, and in the old days, they had this place over in New Jersey where they had these little old ladies who...
No, I was in Connecticut, but okay.
Connecticut, but they would work out on the plates what the colors were, and I remember...
Hand separation.
And I remember they would mix it up every so often. We had one issue of Iron Man where I think the character Rhodes, who was a black man, he ended up being green throughout the entire story because the
plates...
Because
they get the plates reversed, see? Like the blue plate is where the yellow plate should be and all that. Okay, another question. Yes, you, sir.
Being that you worked in the comic book industry, what are your thoughts on sort of the deals that Marvel made and the politics for like how it affected comics, like the AU versus X-Men sort of thing, and like how the politics of the Fox deal? The licensing agreement with Fox affected how writers played out those characters, and basically how like Marvel tried to kill the interest in X-Men. Like, what are your thoughts as creative people that work in comics about that? And then, what do you feel about the Disney deal?
I don't know all that much. I don't think either one of us know much about the politics of them and the deals with the Fox. I am aware that when Perlman was running Marvel, he practically just gave away the X-Men to Murdoch and Fox. They were never happy about that.
Regretted it later.
Yes, mightily. And they had Stan out there just selling everything. At one point, didn't he sell like Spider-Man to three different film companies?
No, that wasn't Stan. That was a guy named Joe Calamari. Joe Squid, that was his name.
Okay. And, the Spectacular, the Mighty.
See, whatever. None of these guys upstairs had ever opened a comic book. So they're out there licensing. This guy, Joe Calamari, who was the vice president, executive vice president of business affairs. So he thinks that the Amazing Spider-Man and the Spectacular Spider-Man and Marvel Tales is three different characters. And so he licenses each one to a different movie company. Well, then they're all suing each other, because it's all Spider-Man, you know? He licensed Iron Man to somebody, and then he licensed the Avengers to somebody else. Well, Iron Man is in the Avengers. You know, the lunacy was ridiculous. It was, and then they had no idea. They thought that practically anybody who walked in the door with $5,000 could like get the rights, all rights, to any Marvel character. And they thought they were stealing the money, you know? Because they didn't realize how valuable this stuff is. This guy, I know, he wanted to do a live-action show. So he went to Marvel and he got the rights to all Marvel characters, all of them, for 2 years, for $25,000. That's a pretty good deal. And they thought they were stealing the money, because they didn't have any understanding. They never opened the book, they didn't care, they thought it was some petty little kid crap, who cares, you know? And it just was a mess. So the Fox is part of that. The Fox deal was part of that. And you are correct, sir. After they grew up a little bit and they started realizing there's millions of dollars at stake here, then they regretted the Fox deal and they started downplaying the X-Men. Because why are they supporting Fox? You know? Anyway, that's... way too long story to tell.
Yeah, probably more for you, Ian, than you two, because you've been in the industry so long. Like, type aside, what actually moves your opinion, moves the needle in terms of bringing non-comic creators into comic shops to become comic
creators? Well, I'll give you a couple of answers. One thing we did at Marvel is we realized that there are potential readers walking past comic book racks every day, and they don't know who Daredevil is, or they don't care. But when we did Star Wars, a good lesson in it, everyone in the universe knew what Star Wars was, and Star Wars sales were through the roof. And because people were buying Star Wars comics, they'd say, well, what's Daredevil then? Or what's Superman? We didn't care. We just wanted to build the industry. If they wanted Superman, that's fine. And so then, with that mindset, we got interested in doing things like G.I. Joe, because it wasn't going to be a person in the United States that knew who G.I. Joe was, and Transformers. And we sort of kept that in mind, that we always had to put some bait out there, to get people to look at a comic book. And once they looked at a comic book, maybe they'd come back and buy Superman. God bless them. Or maybe they'd buy Spider-Man, or whatever. But as long as we were building the industry, and we were interested in single copy sales, we wanted to build the audience. We felt like, when I wrote Superman in the 60s, Superman sold 1.2 million copies in this year. Not because of me, just because, it was people bought comics and it was mass market media. And it had been steadily crushed down until it was like almost a cult thing. And we were trying to build it back up, and we did.
Okay. By that theory, everybody knows who the Avengers are now.
And I have an answer for you. The books suck. I'm telling you, look. No, you pick up a book, it starts in the middle, it ends in the middle. It takes you 12 issues to tell a story, and you're into it for $50, and to get one story. I can go to five movies. If you go to a movie, the Avengers movie, man, there's action, there's romance, there's human interest, it's a big story, and it's complex, and the CGI is incredible, and nobody walks out of there disappointed. Whereas you pick up an issue of the Avengers, you're disappointed.
Here, an audience member asked what it was like going from writing Marvel's cosmic characters to DC's cosmic characters.
Sometimes, to switching over to the different companies, sometimes I would bring along sort of, if not in body, at least the spirit. Mongol is nothing more than Thanos with a different costume and a little different origin. By the time I got to working on Comet, Dan Didio was the head guy up there, and Dan likes to work in chaos. He'll tell you one thing within, and he'll tell you with all sincerity, and within a week that whole situation will have changed. When I started off on Comet, who was Captain Comet at the time, I was supposed to be doing an Adam Strange story, which is what I wanted to do. I was out in Lake Michigan, and he called up and said, we can't use it for, he lost his eyes in something. So Adam Strange was blind and in another story, so we couldn't use him. So he said, you have to do this with Captain Comet. And I remember Captain Comet from when I was a kid in the back of our station wagon going into vacations. Strange Adventures, I would always read Captain Comet. He was pretty boring, so I decided to do some reviving on him, and I was really mad that we couldn't use Adam Strange, and so I walked off down the beach, and before I got back,
I had cooled down and had come up with the entire idea of what I was going to do with Captain Comic, including his dog Tyrone. And so it was just one of those things that sort of fell in all in together. And of that time, Mystery in Space, that particular story arc, is the best one in the lot by far. After that, things kept getting more confusing, and I kept getting pulled more into the DC universe, which created more chaos in what I was doing. By the time we got to the Thanagar Holy War, Mystery in Space has sold well, and so I was getting additional characters pushed onto me, like Animal Man and Firestar, I can't even remember half the names at this point. I wanted to do just the weird Adam Strange and Captain Comet, and it was okay when they added Hawkman. I could work that in, but then there was Animal Man and the Comet Gal.
This is the DC Didiocracy.
Yeah, and you know, by the time we got done, I said, okay, Animal Man gets like two panels in issue three, and I get rid of them as quickly as I can. And,
it must be going.
It just didn't fit in with what we were doing. And by the time we got down to the end on Strange Adventures, it was complete chaos, and I just couldn't get out of there quick enough. Yeah.
You had a question.
What are your thoughts about Marvel telling what
Thanos'
middle name is? Changing his name.
I don't read any of the new Thanos stuff. It's just, it's like, it's not my stuff. I'm not probably going to agree with some of it. I don't want to be getting down on somebody else for their creative effort, so I just avoid it, just to keep the peace as much as possible. And especially not paying any attention now, because I don't work for Marvel anymore. I finished my work with them, and that's the end of that one. No, there's no connection between the comic book people and the movies. There's a layer of bureaucracy in between there that decided that it was just not going to happen at all. And when they wanted to invite me down to the set, they called up Marvel, and Marvel said they didn't have my contact info. This is Marvel editorial. They told them that they had no idea how to get a hold of me. So it took them about a month to help me through. They finally got through to me through Facebook.
Well, ever since the Justice movie came out, a lot of people are hyped up about the race, Superman versus Flash, and they don't realize it all goes back to your work back from 1967, Superman 199. Yep. Tell me again, what inspired you to write that?
Okay, when I was 6 years old, something like that, in Showcase or whatever, one of the DC magazines, they reintroduced the Flash. Billy Schwartz reintroduced the Flash. Call me the main. So I'm six, and I'm fascinated by this character who can, like, you know, run, like, super, super fast. And then I realized Superman has super speed. And so in my little notebook, I'm in first grade, I'm drawing Superman and the Flash racing. Okay? And so, all right, years pass, and now I'm working for DC Comics, 1966. And the editor, Mort Weisinger, calls me up one day, and he says, he's signing a Superman story. You got any ideas for a Superman story? And I said, can I use the Flash? And he said, I think I can arrange that. And I said, all right. And so I wrote the first Superman Flash story.
Back then, that was a really crazy thing about the difference between Marvel and DC characters is that Stan and Jack and Steve really made these human beings, real characters you recognize. Over at DC, they were more or less like ciphers. I mean, they were all created in the 1960s. The Flash and the Green Lantern.
They were recreated in the late 50s, 60s.
They were all 50s and 60s, and that was a kind of a bland period of history in not only comics, but in entertainment in general.
Well, I'll give an example of Green Lantern. Okay, the first issue of Julie Schwartz's revamped Green Lantern, it's like
this alien Adam Sir who's dying and he crashes on Earth. And he's got this, he's got the most powerful weapon in the universe, right? So he's got to find somebody whose will is strong enough to use this weapon, but not use it for evil, use it for good. And with the understanding that evil people will try to take it, okay? So that whole conceit is there. And then it turns out that what he needs is somebody with willpower. What is willpower? It's the ability to overcome fear. So who does he get? Test pilots. Beautiful. Alright? So that I read that book and my smoke was coming out of here and said, wow. And then the next book, Green Lantern's flying around stopping bank robbers with giant green boxing gloves. What happened, you know? So anyway, it's like you said, they immediately turn into a formula. Every DC character has already met the love of his life in the first issue. You know, they all have their secret cave or whatever, you know, their secret identity. It just, it was not good. And the only thing I can say that I when I was at DC, they used to call me their Marvel writer. It was a term Bob Heaney made up to make fun of me, you know. It was an insult, okay? And then when he was talking about the fiefdoms and stuff, I had sort of a natural fiefdom, because I was writing The Legion of Superheroes. It was the only book set 1,000 years in the future, so I own the future, okay? And so I started doing continuity, and I tried not to have the characters be ciphers. I don't know how well I succeeded. I was a kid. I don't know. But what I would do is I would borrow the personalities of my high school classmates. You know, I hope they didn't catch me, you know? But like there was this guy named Tom Kalaski, and he's a self-effacing, funny guy, kept everybody happy, you know, a little chubby, and that's Bouncing Boy. You know, I mean, didn't take himself seriously. No, his name is Bouncing Boy. How the hell are you gonna take yourself seriously? So I mean, I made him into a character, I made him into as much of a person as I could, and so I was trying to do that. And I'm gonna brag here. During the 60s, all the Marvel comics were on the rise, and all the DC comics were falling in sales, okay? Except one, Legion of Superheroes. You read the statement of ownership in the very first issue I wrote, 500,000 copies sold. You read the statement of ownership in the last one I wrote, 500,000 copies sold. Because they don't know what business they're in. They have no idea what business they're in. They think that, you know, it's hard to explain. It's a relationship business. You need to love those characters. And you can't make them people love those characters, you're dead. You know, and also Stan's extended it to make them feel loyalty to you, the creator. You know, there are people out there who you know, look for his name on stuff. Not mine stuff, but his. And you know, I think that it's like if you understand that you're here to entertain people, and this is all about your relationship with them. Comic book business has more in common with a single malt scotch business than it does with magazines or books. You know, because those are, you know, other kinds of purchases. So I'm sorry, I'll shut up.
Okay, last question. Directly taking your lead off of that, in the single malt scotch business of comics, if either of you were to pick your choice of toy out of the toy box at DC, are they going to let you do whatever you wanted with? They would give you full editorial, full promotional support for to just do whatever you want with. Is there something that you would pick, or would you rather do something creative with?
I'd do the weird. My character, I'd be having more fun doing that than I would do a Superman or Batman.
Well, I would hope to be able to do One Eye Creative and also
Bouncing Boy.
Yeah? Bouncing Boy, I didn't create Bouncing Boy. I had nothing to do with Bouncing Boy, except I tried to make him human. But anyway, if I had my ideal situation, I'd create one, and also I'd pick Superman, because he badly needs fixed. Second would be Wonder Woman, because she badly needs fixed. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you. Jim Starlin, everybody.
Thanks for coming.
The great Jim Starlin.
Thank you very much for coming, guys. Thank you.